to the Capitol Press Room for Veterans Day, November 11th. I'm Susan Arbetter. After Tuesday's election, the Green Party moved up on the ballot. Michael O'Neill, co-chair of the Green Party of New York, discusses the party's future with us. We're going to speak for a second time with filmmaker Kathy Leichter, whose documentary, Here One Day, is screening in the Capitol region tomorrow and Thursday. Were some legitimate voters turned away on Election Day because of tough new voter laws? Myrna Perez, deputy director of the Brennan Center's Democracy Program, will fill us in. And we're going to preview the Albany Law School event FOIL at 40, which takes place tomorrow. It's all coming up on this Veterans Day edition of the Capitol Press Room. You know who had a great night last Tuesday was the New York Green Party with Howie Hawkins at the top of the ticket. The Greens garnered 175,000 votes, which is about 65,000 more than last gubernatorial election. Joining me today to discuss the Green Party's successes here in the Empire State as well as nationally is Michael O'Neill, co-chair of the Green Party of New York. Welcome to the Capitol Press Room.
Thanks, Susan. Thanks for having me on.
So this is a stupid question, but how do you feel about Tuesday's results?
Fantastic. You know, it was a lot of hard work, and I was part of Howie's campaign team in 2010, and we were really thrilled with winning ballot status in that election, and then the much greater results in this past election, being part of that campaign team as well. It's a great feeling. People keep talking about low voter turnout across the country and across the state, but it was a pretty high turnout for Greens.
Why do you think that was?
I think because we ran a Green Party candidate on our Green Party ballot line, which is kind of a radical notion for third parties in New York State. But we've proved that running on a Green New Deal, running on a truly progressive agenda, fighting against austerity, whether it's coming from a Republican or a Democrat, as in the governor 1% of our state, if you fight against austerity, if you fight for quality public schools, if you fight to end climate change, if you fight for single-payer health care, people will turn out and vote for you.
It wasn't just a good day for Howie Hawkins. Matt Funicello, who ran on the Green Party line in the 21st Congressional District, won 11% of the vote. That's pretty good.
Matt ran a really competitive campaign. He's an experienced Green Party candidate. He is a pillar of that community. He's a local businessman running an ethical, sustainable business there, a bakery. Fantastic. I've tried it. Everyone should go. And we were really happy to have him be a part of our slate in this this round of elections.
So my understanding is that Howie Hawkins may not run again for governor when the gubernatorial election returns in 4 years. What does that mean for the Greens?
Well, what Howie actually said was that he's not looking to run again, but he is open if the party wants him to run again, if we nominate him, if we want him to run. He's not taking it off the table. But I think what Howie was expressing, and I agree with him, is that this is the time for us to be expanding our bullpen of competitive candidates, whether it's for statewide office, but especially for local office. This is a party, and it's larger than any single one of us. And part of what I admire about Howie is that he has been committed to that principle throughout his entire time as a Green, and it's always been about building the party, not just about his political base, whether it's locally or running as a gubernatorial candidate.
So, Michael, talk to me about Howie Hawkins as a political candidate. What is it that was so attractive about him, do you think?
Well, like I mentioned earlier, he is calling for a platform that a majority of people across the country agree with: real action on climate change, a real public jobs program, quality public schools, single-payer health care, a ban on fracking in New York State. This is what people want. And he actually put those issues out there. And this is part of the value that a third party brings to electoral politics in this country, is that we push for the issues that a majority of people want, but the duopoly corporate parties ignore. Howie got up there in the debate on stage with Andrew Cuomo and told him that it told the world that Cuomo was manipulating the science on the reports on fracking and the environmental impact report. That's the kind of thing that people crave to hear. And looking at some of the post-debate reactions on social media and on different straw polls that some of the different public media sites held, people were thrilled that Howie was in that debate. And I think going forward, we need to have an objective criteria for debates for our statewide campaigns. It shouldn't be up to the candidates to decide who's in. It shouldn't be up to the pundits to decide. I think we should propose that if a candidate will be on the ballot, and if they are polling 5% in a statewide poll, or if in a statewide poll a majority of people say that they want to hear from that candidate in the debate, then they should be in the debate. And we can cut the drama, cut the back and forth in the negotiations, let the people decide, not the candidates, not the pundits.
That's a much lower threshold than a lot of the broadcast outlets have in their rules. It's usually a 10%. Polling at 10% is when a candidate comes in. That said, the candidates have been in charge of outlining the debates for far too long. It's got to be, I agree with you, it has to be something that comes from the people, not the candidates themselves.
Absolutely. And you know, we believe in multi-party democracy, and we believe that it is healthy for a plethora of parties and candidates to be able to compete in New York State. And we want to be part of that, of course, but we don't want to just shut the door behind us. So that's why we're looking for a fair, objective criteria that will apply to, you know, any candidate who's really running a statewide campaign.
Sure, Michael. The reason I asked you about Howie Hawkins as a candidate is because while he did very well this year and 4 years ago, you don't seem to have a deep bench when it comes to other candidates who can run. Or am I wrong?
Well, we have a job in front of us, and that is to strengthen our relationships with the thousands of people who came to us this year as supporters and volunteers. And we need to build our local party organizations and infrastructure to recruit candidates. There are thousands of dynamic leaders on some of the issues that I've talked about, single payer, banning fracking, et cetera. And we want to be a venue where those candidates can run and run for office, actually calling for the demands of those movements. A big part of our success this year was Brian Jones as our fantastic lieutenant governor candidate as Howie's running mate. Brian brought with him a constituency of public educators who have been fighting for quality, fully funded public education for a long time now. And both Brian's dynamism as a candidate and that constituency and his history of work on that issue, fighting against the charterization of our public schools, was a big part of our success this year.
Is that a new word, charterization?
We've been using that for a while, but you can credit the Green Party for that.
Okay.
I won't turn it down.
The New York Post writes, in sharp contrast, every other minor party with a permanent ballot line backed either Democratic Governor Cuomo or GOP candidate Rob Astorino, thanks to New York's bizarre system of allowing cross endorsements. And except for the conservatives, all their totals declined. This was in a Post editorial titled Two Cheers for the Green Party. Why don't Greens cross endorse?
We are committed to the idea of building independent politics in New York State and across the country. Political independence is written right into our DNA as an organization. And
you think that helped pay off this at the voting box?
Absolutely. Taking the shortcut of cross-endorsing the duopoly parties, the corporate parties, at the expense of your own party's value or your own party's values is it may help you in the short term, maybe by achieving ballot status, but in the long term, your members who might have come to you with great enthusiasm and idealism will realize that if you're not capable of standing on your own 2 feet, then you're not living up to what you've set as your ideals. I think that running, well, we say that fusion leads to confusion. And in this past election, In this past election, Fusion was a farce, with candidates, deep pocket candidates, pulling ballot lines out of thin air.
So it was, there was a moment at which point Howie had written to the Working Families Party and said, consider me as your candidate, and they never got back to him. You think they're kicking themselves in the tush now?
I think the rank and file Working Families Party members did consider Howie, and a lot of them voted for Howie and Brian. And I think that the Working Families Party leadership have not wavered from their goal, or at least how they operate, which is as a caucus within the Democratic Party in New York State. And there are a lot of institutional reasons for that. And people, the members of that party, if they want to be a part of a party that will run truly progressive candidates for the progressive issues like a ban on fracking, single payer health care.
Are you going to be reaching out to them? I mean, officially?
We already are.
Yeah.
We I live in Brooklyn, which is kind of the stronghold of the Working Families Party. And, you know, my fellow co-chair, Gloria Matera, she was out on the street corner on election day next to Dan Kanner. And
Families Party for my listeners.
Exactly. And we encounter Working Families Party members all the time. They're interested in what we're doing. They were interested in Howie as a candidate. We have made, I think at this point, several official overtures to the Working Families Party leadership. They know where we are, and if they want to talk, we'll listen. But we are committed to running Green Party candidates on the Green Party ballot line. And actually, our party rules at this point prohibit cross-endorsing both the two corporate parties and what we call their allied parties, which are the parties that routinely cross-endorse with them, such as WFP, the Independence Party, and the Conservative Party.
How did things go nationally? We don't have much time, but I just wanted to get a sense of it.
We picked up more ballot lines across the country. We went from 14 to 19. And so that is a great indicator of the health of the party overall. We talk about in New York State how it's critical to have a permanent ballot line, and that applies across the country. There are different thresholds for winning ballot lines across the country. But like I said, we ended up with more than we had going into Tuesday. So that helps us run local candidates across the country, but also with things like the presidential race. Having more guaranteed ballot lines allows us to focus more on campaigning and less on gathering signatures.
We are out of time, but I want to thank you for joining us. Big day for the Green Party last Tuesday. Michael O'Neill is co-chair of the Green Party of New York. Many thanks.
Thank you, Susan.
You may remember that a few months ago we met filmmaker Kathy Leichter, who wrote and produced the documentary Here One Day about her mother Nina, who committed suicide after struggling with bipolar disorder. The film derives a lot of its content from archival footage and audio tapes, photos and recordings that she made during her manic period, but it's a brutally honest depiction of how mental illness and suicide affects an entire family. Here One Day is going to be screened tomorrow at 6 p.m. at the Clifton Park Public Library, as well is on Thursday, November 13th at 6:30 p.m. at SUNY Adirondack in Queensbury. And Kathy Leichter joins us now to talk about it. Hi, Kathy. Welcome back.
Hi, Susan. Thank you.
So the last time you were here, you talked a little bit about why you made Here One Day. Let's talk about that again for my listeners who didn't catch that interview.
Sure. Well, the film really grew out of my own personal experience of living with my mom, who was diagnosed with bipolar disorder and died by suicide when I was 28 in 1995. So the film came out of really a lot of grief and personal healing that I needed and wanted to do. And I've been a filmmaker, for a long, long time. And so this is my medium. But the film has become a very powerful tool for mental health education work that I'm doing all across the country, and using the film as an opportunity for communities to speak openly about mental health and mental health support and suicide prevention and suicide loss and how to support survivors and how to really talk about these feelings, these experiences that are still so stigmatized in our society, and yet so many of us know somebody in our family, somebody, have mental illness ourselves, you know, are struggling with these things, and we don't end up talking about it. And the movie provides a space to do that.
We have a little trailer from the film that we'd like to play now. So Darian in Syracuse, if you hear me, why don't you play the clip from Here One Day?
We put her in New York psychiatric. Well, they were going to put her in a straitjacket. It was awful.
She did really bizarre things, dangerous things. I did not feel safe.
Oh, dear. This is a bad moment.
The disease was intensifying and getting worse. Nobody stepped in to take command.
Everything just conspired, like a Greek tragedy, and just pointing inexorably towards that end.
Everything conspired inexorably toward that end. That was your father, Franz Leichter, I believe. Am I right?
Yeah.
And he was a state senator. What was it like for a family in the public eye to go through something like this?
Well, I think that it was challenging. I mean, I think it's challenging for any family, to figure out how to support the loved one or support the one who's, struggling, and then also to, support the family members who are also struggling. That's really one of the main points of the film. There are many, many points of the film, but one of the main ones is that the whole family is affected, not just the individual. And I think caring for the individual means also caring for the family. So that's something I stress often when I go to schools and to psychiatry residents, nursing students, social work students. But I think for our family in particular, because my father was a state senator and, often went to Albany, and I mean, every month he was going, it was really challenging. He had a lot of responsibilities out of the house, and so that meant that he wasn't always there or able to support my mom. And one thing I remember my aunt, my mother's sister, saying when my mom took her life was that she was so proud of our family and proud of my father for right at the time, saying that my mom had died by suicide and that she had suffered from a mental illness. So it makes me think about Robin Williams and, the press that went out after his death. And just to be, for my dad, as a politician, to be open about that in 1995 was important. I mean, he was doing social action, by being honest about what happened, because that's, I believe, how we're going to create change and provide more support, is to say this is happening and this did happen to our family and it's happening to other families, and to say it out loud, to say the words out loud.
There was some friction among members of your family about what to do with your mom, wasn't there? Mm-hmm.
There was. It was very challenging. I mean, my brother and I were in our 20s, and, my dad was open to our ideas and our help, but, there were four of us at least, family members, including my aunt, my mom's sister, thinking about my mom's care, and my uncle, and, the whole family was involved, and there were conversations about the medication, and we did ECT, and, I hope now that families are given more support than we were, but I don't know if that's always the case, and then it's hard sometimes. There can be conflict within the family, and how do you get everyone in the room even to give them all therapy if you wanted to? I mean, it's a hard thing to think about, how to support the family, and often there's conflict because there is so, everybody needs help, and everybody needs more understanding and someone to listen to them, and it does mean more resource.
Yeah. When you go and do these screenings for groups, which you do all over the country, what kind of questions do you get from the audience?
That's such a great question. I get a whole range. I get questions about the filmmaking process. I get questions, how's your brother doing now? You know, how's your family? You know, what was it like to grow up with your mom? How has this movie changed you spiritually? Are you angry? You know, what can I do? My uncle just died by suicide. Did the movie help you to, you know, deal with your mom's death? Should I make a movie? You know, what should I do with my story? I'm writing a book about my own mental illness. You know, how can you help me, you know, get my book out?
Wow.
I mean, I get such a range. I mean, people are just, you know, popping with things to say. And I love that. I mean, I'm very open emotionally, and I want to be a sounding board for people to air some of this.
Isn't it
helps.
Isn't it hard, though? A reviewer in Huffington Post, who is a mental health professional, wrote that suicide is hardest on the ones left behind. And in the Leichter family, we see its corrosion on each member, still with flush feelings over two decades after their loss. Doesn't showing this movie sort of open the wound every time for you?
You know, perhaps it does, but I actually find that to be, with support, I find that to be a positive thing. I find that the more I confront this, the more I look at it, the more I'm able to feel the range of feelings that still exist about it, I grow and I change, and it becomes less loaded. Like, there's a scene in the film where my father says, "What do you hope to find?" And as I'm going through all her things and I say more freedom, I still feel very gripped by the loss of her. And I don't feel gripped in the same way by the loss of her anymore. I mean, this work for me has been so powerful. I don't feel gripped. I mean, I love her and I miss her and I wish she were alive, but I'm me in a different way because I've been able to open the wound and look at it and feel things about it. And I hope, you know, I can do that for other people in a safe space. I mean, I do always encourage people to get support. And with both of these screenings, we're working with local mental health groups and community human services in Saratoga County.
Let me give out some details. Here One
sure.
Day is the name of the film. It's going to be screened tomorrow at 6 p.m. at the Clifton Park Library. And then on the 13th, which is Thursday at 6:30 p.m. at SUNY Adirondack in Queensbury. For more information, just go to www.hereoneday.com. Hereoneday.com. It's all spelled out. Kathy Leichter, it's always good to speak with you. Thank you.
Thanks, Susan.
Several states, including North Carolina, Kansas, and Virginia, went into Election Day last week with new voter restrictions on the books. Did these new laws make a difference? Today we speak with Myrna Perez, Deputy Director of the Brennan Center's Democracy Program, about the issue. Myrna, welcome to the Capitol Press Room.
Thank you so much for having me.
How many states have implemented voter restrictions that were in place last Tuesday?
There were 14 that were in place, and to be really clear, there were more than that, but there were 14 that were in place for the first time in a major election.
All right. How, you know, why don't we take a look at three states in particular, the three that I mentioned, starting with North Carolina. These are all pretty tight races. In North Carolina, Tom Tillis beat Senator Kay Hagan by about 48,000 votes, according to the Brenner Center website. So what changed in North Carolina that may have affected voters?
Well, the thing that we point out is the fact that the North Carolina legislature passed what has been said to be the most draconian voting rights law in recent memory. Many of your audience members may recall that in the summer of 2013, the Supreme Court struck down an important provision of the Voting Rights Act, which provided protections to voters in states like North Carolina against discrimination at the ballot box.
Was this Shelby?
The Shelby County decision. That's exactly right. And after the Shelby County decision came down, the state legislature made the choice to pass a really extensive omnibus bill that did a whole bunch of things, including imposing campaign finance law problems, but most importantly, it created a number of barriers to the ballot box. It eliminated same-day registration. It ended some days of early voting and eliminated the ability to pre-register people when they are 16 or 17 when they go to the DMV. It imposed a photo identification requirement. And we all know, people who study this issue know, that turnout in this country is very low to begin with. We have just a portion of our eligible Americans participating in the electoral process, and every time you put an additional barrier in front of the ballot box, you're going to get some number of people who are unable to participate. You know, some are interested in this issue because of razor-thin margins. I personally am interested in this issue because it's about the fundamental right to vote, and elections are unique moments in time.
What?
If a voter has not been able to participate in an election, then their voice is forever lost at that moment in time, and re-enfranchising them in another election isn't going to make them whole for the right that was lost at that particular election.
So, Myrna, there are a couple schools of thought here. One you articulated just now. Another is that there is rampant voter fraud, and that states need to do what they can to prevent people voting twice, or people who aren't registered voting, or undocumented immigrants voting. Do we have any proof that that is as big of a problem as some people say?
I mean, I would just push a little bit back on the question. I don't think there's very much dispute at all that our elections need to be secure. I think there is no dispute that only eligible people should be participating in our elections. The question is how. Like, how are we going to prevent ineligible people from participating? We know that some kinds of electoral improprieties are very, very rare. We know that a lot of electoral improprieties occur by insiders, people who, you know, are part of the process, who know how to manipulate it and who know how to avoid detection. And when we see these kinds of restrictions being put on an average voter's ability to participate, you know, I always like to examine what is the problem that is trying to be fixed and whether or not this will fix it. You know, there's not a lot of evidence that was being raised in North Carolina that 16 and 17-year-olds, when they were pre-registering, were somehow improperly voting in North Carolina. So not allowing someone to pre-register to vote when they're going to get their driver's license doesn't seem like a good trade-off to make, because what that means is that someone is going to have to take the extra step of getting that young person participating, and someone is going to have to hope that you know, a voter registration drive comes and knocks on their door, or that they are given the opportunity in school, or that they're somehow given access to register in another way, as opposed to just getting them on the rolls when they're right there, like many Americans already do. And we are not in a position where the restrictions that we see being imposed are like the kinds of problems that we see. One perfect example of this is in Texas, where they imposed a really strict photo identification requirement, and the only kind of fraud that photo identification requirements fix are somebody pretending to be someone else. You know, Texas's own expert found that there were two incidences of someone doing that in the last 10 years. And we had more people in the courtroom who couldn't vote because of this new strict photo identification law. So the question is not about whether or not we should have secure rolls. The question is not about whether or not our electoral process should have integrity. That's something that everybody wants. The big issue is, what are we going to do to get it, and are we actually achieving what we're attempting to do, and who is being disenfranchised in the process?
Right, and a lot of these may be disenfranchising voters. What also gets me is from the Brennan Center website in Florida, that sometimes candidates are benefiting from the voter restriction laws that they helped put into place. And one of those people was Rick Scott, who beat former Governor Charlie Crist by, you know, 70,000 votes or something like that.
Right. I mean, I think you're referring to the fact that Governor Crist, when he was Governor Crist, issued an executive order that would ease the restrictions on voting rights to people with criminal convictions in Florida. I suspect that much of your audience would be surprised to hear that there are 1.3 million Floridians who are living and working in the community but cannot vote because they have a criminal conviction in their past.
Even though they've served their sentence and they're out of jail.
Right. They're out of jail. They're living. They're working. They're paying taxes. They're being expected to raise family. They're being expected to be productive citizens. But they are permanently blocked from the electoral process unless they are expressly given a pardon by the government. Governor Crist had established a mechanism such that people with criminal convictions in their past could more easily get that pardon. And one of the first things that Governor Scott did was to eliminate that executive order issued by Governor Crist. And so now we're back to a point where there are millions of, you know, there's more than a million Floridians who can't get their voting rights back. And, you know, these are fewer people than are voting. And when I think most Americans, irrespective of your political leanings, don't want our politicians manipulating the rules of the game to their own benefit. And so when you have politicians who are, you know, targeting certain people to disenfranchise, I think it raises a lot of questions.
Do you think that was the case here, targeting certain people?
Well, there's no question that Governor Scott knew what he was doing by repealing the executive order. There's no question that he knew that repealing the executive order was going to make it harder for people with criminal convictions to get their rights restored. And there's no question that he knew that that Florida has one of the strictest of these laws in the country. There's also no public safety justification for this kind of law. In fact, a number of police officers and criminal justice professionals say that if we want people to be productive members of society, if we want their reentry into society to be successful, we need to give them a vote because that makes them stakeholders, that forces them to engage in pro-social behavior that is consistent with being community-minded. So there's not a policy justification for denying the right to vote for people who have criminal convictions and are living and working in the community, and yet yet you will have a meaningful impact on those communities because those people will have lost their voice.
Is there any evidence that voter restrictions like, for example, a photo ID requirement disenfranchises people of color more than white people?
There is. There have been a number of studies that suggest that minorities, poor people, women, elderly, students are less likely to have the kind of identification that is required by these very strict laws.
Why don't we discuss some electoral reforms that the Brennan Center supports? You think revamping voter registration would be a good idea. The system is heavily reliant on pen and paper forms, which lead to typos and errors, and we should make sure that this is done electronically. Is that really going to help expand the voter pool?
Well, certainly, and it won't just help expand the voter pool. It'll help our election administration. I mean, let me just explain a little bit. When someone registers to vote at, say, a government agency, they have to provide they're doing that in the course of conducting other business. They're there for other services. In large part, to get those services, you have to give the same kind of information that you need to give in order to register to vote. You need to tell them what your name is. You need to tell them what your birthday is. You need to tell them, like, what your address is. In many instances, you have to tell them what your citizenship status is. And instead of handing somebody a piece of paper and asking them to fill out all that same information again and then have that piece of paper be bundled and then have that piece of paper be mailed so that someone else has to read somebody's handwriting and try and type it in for it to get put on another piece of paper that's going to the election, going to the poll site, the computers should just talk to each other. The computer at the agency should just talk to the computers in the election offices. It'll be a lot cheaper because you don't have to do the mailing and the bundling and the typing in. You get to save staff time because you don't have to worry about someone not being able to read someone else's chicken scratch or having to try and decipher something that got coffee spilled on it or got caught in the rain.
It's amazing any doctors vote at all.
And then it makes the rolls cleaner because you don't have these kinds of mistakes written on the written into the system because somebody had a hard time reading someone else's handwriting. So a number of states have this. It's what we call electronic registration that exists primarily at DMVs. So in a lot of DMVs across the country, you go in and they ask you, do you want to register to vote? You say yes. And then they send that information over to the election office. And we should do that.
New York has that, right? Motor voter?
Yep. Well, all states have motor voter, but the electronic portion of it is a new development. And when you do go to the DMVs at in New York, the information is conveyed electronically. It's not a perfectly electronic system, but it's a lot better than what some of the other states have. But it's something that, you know, is a common sense use of modern technology. It saves a lot of money. I think people would be very surprised to hear that their taxpayers are being spent, you know, handwriting in forms, you know, having someone decipher it and hand typing them in when, this can be stuff, the data can be sent electronically.
A couple other reforms include same-day registration and early voting. We only have about 30 seconds, Myrna, but I was wondering if New York State had any problems at the election sites on Tuesday. Have you heard of any?
Yeah, I mean, we did. We heard of a number of people not being registered, even though they wanted to be. We heard a lot of people who didn't know what their polling locations were. We had a lot of people with troubles with voting machines and not understanding what the ballots did. There's a lot we can do, but, you know, we need to get people out there participating and voting, and we need people to talk to their representatives and let them know that voting matters and elections matter, and we need to make sure we have the resources that we need to do it right.
Well, I want to direct people to the Brennan Center's website. It's brennancenter.org. There's a lot of good information there. Myrna Perez is the deputy director of the Center's Democracy Program. It's always a pleasure. Thanks, Myrna. We appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
This past September 1st, 2014, the Freedom of Information Law, known as FOIL, turned 40 years old. And tomorrow, Albany Law School is throwing it a party. But before we get to the details of the party, let's talk about FOIL. What is it? You've likely heard about news organizations and other groups foiling information. What it means is that they've made a legal request for documents from the government, typically documents that the government doesn't want you to see. One example of how FOIL has worked, back in 2010 and 11, the New York Times foiled information regarding the state's handling of abuse allegations at institutions for the disabled. The paper found that the state's hiring practices permitted the rehiring of staff who had been fired for abusing patients at other institutions for the disabled that the state has run. So the sunlight around the paper shined on the practice, helped to reform some of the state's laws around people with disabilities. Joining us today to discuss FOIL as well as tomorrow's festivities is Ray Brescia, Associate Professor of Law and Director of the Government Law Center at Albany Law School. Welcome back.
Good morning, Susan. It's good to be back.
So why are we celebrating a law about government transparency?
Well, in today's complex world, it's hard to say that there's a more important issue than government transparency, that we, whether it's at the state, local, federal level, our government, we need to know that our government is working in our best interest, and the Freedom of Information Law that we have in New York State, which was one of the first state Freedom of Information laws to be passed back in the 70s, in the wake of Watergate, just a few weeks after Nixon resigned, really creates this mechanism through which citizens of New York State and the press can get access to government records and data to help them feel confident that the state is acting and local governments are acting in their best interest.
Why don't you tell us something about what's going to happen tomorrow at Albany Law School, and then we'll talk more later about the FOIA law itself.
Sure. So we've got a discussion that'll take place at 2 o'clock at the law school. You are going to be our moderator, and we're going to have some of the leading lights on the subject of the state's freedom of information law, including Peter Henner from representing the NYCLU, Camille Jobin-Davis from the New York State Committee on Open Government, Brendan Lyons from the Albany Times Union, Jeffrey Perlman, who works in the legislature, or Tim Hafer from the Empire Center for Public Policy are going to discuss, where are we at with this law. The idea is, the title is FOIL at 40, looking back, looking forward, seeing, does this law as currently drafted in the age of Watergate, in the age of wiretapping and other issues of government secrecy, is this, a 20th century law? Is it ready for the 21st century in the age of the Internet and smartphones? So looking at sort of taking stock, where are we and where are there things that we need to do moving forward if the law needs to be updated? These are some of the things that we're going to talk about tomorrow. It's an event that's free and open to the public. All you need to do is register, and you can do so on the Albany Law website.
Albany Law website, just go there, register. It's free. It's going to be great. We'll be right back with Ray Brescia. Ray Brush is my guest with the Albany Law School. So tomorrow we're also going to be celebrating not just FOIL, but something that goes hand in hand with FOIL, and that's the open meetings law. What does that do?
Well, it means that the entities, government entities in the state need to have open meetings, need to have their proceedings open to the public. It does go hand in hand with the freedom of information law.
Yet somehow they go into executive session sometimes, and that's not open to the public.
There are provisions in the law for the government to operate in secret, if you would, when there's a compelling need to do so.
Some people think that the state's FOIL law does need to be updated and strengthened. What are some ways that FOIL could be strengthened? Can you tell us that?
I think the biggest frustration that the general public and the press might have is sometimes the legal wrangling that goes back, with a government agency. And I'm not unsympathetic to either side of the question, because I think sometimes, government officials feel like, well, I just want to do my job. I don't want to have to report on the job I'm doing to anyone who wants to know about it. Unfortunately, that is the price of democracy. I think a positive thing that's happening is, the state is starting to do this. The city in New York City is starting to do this. We're just sort of in advance, putting lots of information up online, making it available to people so that they don't have to go through a FOIL request. I think another piece, so that's one thing, encouraging government to do that. I think the state government is doing that. As he said, New York City is doing that. And people are taking that information and doing great things with it. I'd like to talk about one thing in a moment. But I think another piece of the puzzle is, this wrangling that can sometimes take months, if not years. One piece of the puzzle is, making for attorneys who bring these cases, for private citizens who hire attorneys, bring these cases, make attorneys' fees available if the government's position was, not supported by the law. Because there are exceptions and there are reasons why a government doesn't have to turn over some information. Right now, a court may give attorneys' fees to someone who has to bring a lawsuit to get this information. I personally would like to see those attorneys' fees available in more instances.
Yeah, people should know that these are really expensive lawsuits to bring, and usually big papers like Hearst, for example. We're going to have Brendan Lyons on tomorrow, but Hearst will go to court. But if you're just a regular private person, you may not have the wherewithal to go to court against the state.
That's right, and so making those attorney's fees more readily available would be a positive thing. Now, I want to talk about one other thing. In New York State, is this great program. People can look at it. iQuant New York, and is an example of what can happen when average citizens have access to information. One example of what they've done is they looked at the top grossing fire hydrants in New York City in terms of parking tickets. And they found two in the Lower East Side that were around the corner from each other, and they documented, this combined those fire hydrants were grossing the city over $50,000 a year. And when they looked into it, it was because the markings around those fire hydrants were unclear. And it looked like, you could park next to those fire hydrants because there was a space between the fire hydrant and the curb, and there were designated parking spaces right there. It was almost like a trap. So the folks documented this and sent it into the DOT, and the DOT made more clear markings on the sidewalks. And that's something,
great.
The DOT wasn't trying to trap anybody.
No.
But, average citizens took this information and made this information, available to the public and then to the government. And the government responded appropriately, I think. And I think that's something that's missed here. I think that, generally, our people who work in government are fine public servants. They want to do the right thing. And having, as they say, sunlight is the best disinfectant, having some sunlight on their activities can be helpful to make sure we're governing in the best interests of the public. Because that's what it's about, and that's what the Freedom of Information laws are about.
How does New York's Freedom of Information law compare with other states?
Well, it does have very clear guidelines, I think, although there's often this legal wrangling over where the exceptions lie. It has very specific deadlines within which a government entity has to respond. They're supposed to respond generally within 5 business days and report to the requester, how they're going to respond to it. There's clear guidelines in terms of appeals. It's very broad. Other states, there are limits on who can seek information, but New York's Freedom of Information law has been interpreted very broadly to say anybody can request, any person can request information through our Freedom of Information law. So an interesting fact about our Freedom of Information law, and it's sort of hard to either fathom in our hyper-partisan atmosphere, this law passed in 1974 without a single dissenting vote. In the Senate, in the Assembly, it passed unanimously, which is pretty remarkable to even contemplate.
It is, but consider the context, post Watergate.
Yeah. Yes, no, that's absolutely right.
Also, it wasn't the legislature was nowhere near as divided, I think, then under Nelson Rockefeller, right?
Under Wilson.
Wilson. Yeah, Rockefeller was already out of here. Let's talk about some other issues, like the fact that a lot of the reporters here in this room will file FOIL requests, and even though there are rules around timeliness, they're broken by the government. How is that possible?
Well, all the law requires is that they, in 5 days you've got to report to the requester sort of how you're going to proceed. And then the law simply says, they've got to respond in a reasonable amount of time. And given the task of sometimes bringing all the information together and copying it or reducing it to electronic form can take some time. I think the agencies don't always respond as quickly as people would like, and that's understandable that people want the information quickly. And I think you can speak about particular instances where perhaps a government agency was dragging its feet, but that's the law has escape valves, if you would, that you can deem your request denied, you know, after a particular amount of time, and you can file an appeal. You can then, you know, deem that appeal denied if they don't respond in a particular, you know, within a particular time frame, and then you can go to court, and that can take some time too. But you know, when a court is breathing down a government agency's back, you know, it tends to get the attention of the government agency.
Yeah.
Again, I think that these requests can be burdensome. At times, I'm not unsympathetic to the government, but you know, the public has a right to know, and we're going to talk about some of these issues tomorrow.
We are indeed. FOIL at 40. It's going to be at the Albany Law School. It's free. It starts tomorrow with 2 panel discussion, and then we'll be celebrating some of the people who have helped the FOIL law in New York thrive. We've been speaking with Ray Brescia. Thank you so much.
Thank you. See you tomorrow.
Bye bye.